Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Jonathan Evans, and Steve Ember. But first, this report. Before the new coronavirus began spreading around the world, Sarah Sowers was thinking about what she would do after high school. The 17-year-old from Florida had planned to visit 7 colleges this spring to help her decide where to continue her education. In the United States, high school students often visit colleges and universities they might attend before they officially seek admission. But like so many things during Sowers' final year of high school, the coronavirus pandemic has pushed the process online. Sowers has had to depend on virtual visits, learning about schools through video meetings with college officials. Her mother, Ebru Ural, says she worries how the pandemic might affect her daughter's college experience itself in a few short months. We're dealing with the unknown, and we're trying to make such a huge decision. She invested the better part of the last year trying to earn acceptance to these institutions, Ural said, but we really don't know what we're buying right now. The Associated Press reported her comments. The pandemic has affected plans for millions of students, both in the United States and overseas. Many are making virtual visits to schools while dealing with concerns about paying for a college education in an economic downturn. They also are wondering whether college campuses will even reopen by late summer. Boston University, for example, has already canceled all in-person summer activities at its main campus. And the university's plan for dealing with the pandemic states that if health officials say it is unsafe to reopen this year, it may wait until January 2021. Earlier this month, Harvard University's president said Harvard is considering several possible plans of action. Yet the future is still very unclear. Oregon State University and University of Arizona officials have expressed hope their schools would reopen, but shared similar concerns about what the future holds. In efforts to keep student enrollment numbers up, colleges are offering interactive one-on-one online meetings using video services like Zoom. Hundreds of schools have given families more time to decide by delaying the date of their first required payment from May 1st to June 1st. In addition, the Associated Press reports that the two leading college admissions tests, the SAT and the ACT, have been canceled. So a growing number of schools are removing admissions test requirements for students entering college. But for all the schools' efforts, many families say it is difficult to look forward when students are still finishing high school from home. Opinion studies have found that large numbers of American high school seniors plan to spend at least a year working or traveling before attending college. Studies also have shown that many Americans may decide against the first choice school on their list of colleges because it is too costly. Others say they would feel safer attending a school closer to home. About 3.7 million American students are expected to graduate from high school this year. Nearly 70% expected to start college in the late summer. Lauren Kohler of Connecticut was planning to spend her high school's spring break visiting three universities. They are the University of South Carolina, Florida State University, and the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Kohler visited South Carolina last year, but now the 18-year-old is depending on virtual visits and friends' experiences to learn about Florida State. She also recently walked around an empty UMass Amherst campus. I'm a big believer that you can walk on a campus and say, "This is my school," or "This is not my school," said Kohler. It really depends on the feeling and the type of people that are there. Grace Malloy of Oregon did get a chance to visit Long Island University Post in New York. But her spring break visits to Nebraska Wesleyan University and the University of Northern Colorado were canceled. Malloy also wanted to see six other schools. Now she is worried she will not know how to reduce the number of choices on her list. "Decision-making is not my strong suit," she said, after completing her third virtual visit of the week. I'm Pete Musto.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we are going to talk about being trapped indoors for a long period of time. Sometimes we are stuck indoors with others and are unable to go out to usual places, such as restaurants, movie theaters, and sporting events. Sometimes these restrictions are forced upon us. We have little choice in the matter. People in this situation may develop cabin fever. Cabin fever is a condition. It happens when someone is stuck inside for a long period of time. If someone is unable to get outside into fresh air or be around other human beings, they may start to feel closed in, stuck, trapped. When people are forced to stay in a remote or confined place, they may feel unhappy, restless, and bored. We have many other adjectives to describe cabin fever. Because our patience is tested, we may feel irritable and short-tempered. The smallest thing sets us off, or in other words, makes us angry. Every little thing gets on our nerves. Word historians say cabin fever probably came into use in the late 1800s in North America. Early settlers lived in log cabins. They would spend long winters by themselves on the Great Plains. Cold, windy weather and great distances from other people created a truly isolating existence for months at a time. Documents at the United States Library of Congress suggest another origin for the term cabin fever. This one involves the disease typhus. In August of 1906, a woman named Mary Mallon began work as a cook in a wealthy home in New York State. By September, several people in that household got the disease typhus. Health officials traced the cause back to the cook, Mary. The LOC documents say that on March 19, 1907, she was forcibly removed from her home by the health department. Typhoid Mary, as she was called in the press, was first sent to the hospital, then to an isolated cabin. Mary Mallon fought for her release. She had private tests done to prove she did not have typhoid. Her story was often reported in many newspapers, and she gained sympathy in the press. On July 10, 1909, the Richmond Planet ran the story, Typhus Mary Wants Liberty. In it, Mallon says she was forced to live in a house by herself with only a dog for companionship. She had been in forced quarantine for about 2 years. Then, in February 1910, Typhoid Mary was released on one condition, that she never work as a cook again. However, she broke that condition, this time under a different name, Mary Brown. In 1915, typhoid broke out again, this time at a hospital. It turned out that Mary Mallon was again at the center of it. And again, officials took her away. Typhoid Mary spent the last 23 years of her life in forced isolation. And this time, no one felt bad or sided with her. The press continued to call her Typhoid Mary, a name that has stuck. The case of Typhoid Mary is a serious example of forced isolation, and most likely she suffered from cabin fever. These days, however, we usually use the term in a more lighthearted way. We might say, I have a serious case of cabin fever. I need to get out of my house. And that's all the time we have for Words and Their Stories. Join us again next week for another closer look at the English language. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Many people in Abuja, Nigeria, have grown tired of staying inside during the country's lockdown to limit the spread of the new coronavirus. As a result, hundreds of people are doing group exercises on one of the Nigerian capital's highways. They seem to have little concern for the COVID-19 disease that has killed at least 10 and infected at least 300 others in Nigeria. Akinyemi Busayo is a trader. Recently, he was doing aerobics and other exercises in a group. He said, "Since the lockdown, we are just at home doing nothing, no work, no food, nothing, nothing. So we decided to come and exercise our body instead of us sitting at home and just getting fat." Behind Busayo was a group of people on a bridge going across one of Abuja's large highways. They were doing sit-ups as a group of runners ran between them. The government has ordered people to remain indoors and isolate themselves unless they need necessary goods such as food, water, or medical services. But enforcement of the order has been mixed. Some security officials have beaten and arrested people found outside, even health workers. Other officials have done nothing, as with the crowds of people exercising in Abuja. Agbula Sabanat is a student. He told Reuters that he does not believe the new coronavirus has reached the area. He added, "Everyone is scared, like my mom, she is scared. She is like, I should not go out for this workout that they said everybody should be at home, that we should just keep cool and stay at home. But I can't." I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the administration of the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter. It is January 20th, 1977, Inauguration Day. America's newly elected president, Jimmy Carter, is on his way to the White House after his swearing-in ceremony at the Capitol building. But the new president is not riding in a car, he is walking. His wife, Rosalind, and his daughter, Amy, walk with him. Crowds along Pennsylvania Avenue cheer. Bands play. On this cold day in Washington, Americans look to the future. Watergate, the crisis that led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon, is several years in the past. The Vietnam War is history, too. Republican Gerald Ford served the remaining years of Nixon's term. Many people believe he brought respect and order back to the government. Yet he lost the office to Democrat Jimmy Carter in the election of 1976. The nation still has problems. Unemployment is high. So is inflation. But the future of the nation looks bright. Jimmy Carter feels sure about his future, too. On the day before his inauguration, he said,
"I do feel that the people of this nation, and I think the entire world, wish me well and want to see me succeed as president. And that gives me a sense of reassurance and confidence. I think I'm ready now to be president."
During the election campaign, Carter often said he would be different from other presidents. He told voters he was not a member of the Washington political establishment, so he would do things in his own independent way. Carter was from Georgia, in the deep south of the United States. There had not been a president born in the South in more than 100 years. Carter studied nuclear engineering and attended the United States Naval Academy. He planned to stay in the Navy. Then his father died, and he decided to return to Georgia to operate the family peanut farm. Carter began his political life on the committee that supervised schools in his hometown of Plains, Georgia. He also served in other local offices. In 1966, he failed to win the Democratic nomination for governor of Georgia. For the next 4 years, he traveled around the state gathering support. He won the next election. As governor, Carter earned praise for reorganizing the state government. He also reformed state programs dealing with prisons and mental health care. In 1972, he offered himself as a candidate for vice president with presidential candidate George McGovern. But the Democratic Party chose someone else. Carter did not wait long to begin his next political move. He would try to win the Democratic presidential nomination in 1976. Jimmy Carter was hardly known outside the state of Georgia. Political experts gave him little chance. Even his mother was surprised to learn that he wanted to be president. President of what, she asked. But the farmer and former governor had a plan. He would try to win his party's primary elections in the South. He believed this would give him enough support at the party convention to win the nomination. Other Democratic candidates tried to stop him, but his plan worked. By the time of the convention, he had enough support to win the nomination on the first ballot. In the general election, Carter defeated President Ford by almost 2% of the popular vote. He lost in the West and Middle West, but won the South and Northeast. President Carter believed strongly in human rights. He hoped he could use his new position to support human rights throughout the world. On this and other issues, he was not afraid of being criticized when he believed he was right. For example, he believed it was right for the United States to end its control of the Panama Canal. He won congressional support for treaties to give control to Panama by the year 2000. He believed it was right to give diplomatic recognition to Communist China. And he believed it was right to continue negotiations with the Soviet Union about limiting nuclear weapons, even though he denounced human rights violations there. In 1979, Carter and Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev signed the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, known as SALT II. However, Carter decided not to send the treaty to the Senate for approval after the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan later that year. One of the finest moments of Carter's presidency took place at Camp David. That is the holiday home of American presidents. There, in March 1979, President Anwar Sadat of Egypt met with Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel. They signed a peace treaty ending 30 years of war between their countries.
We are privileged to witness tonight a significant achievement in the cause of peace, an achievement none thought possible a year ago or even a month ago, an achievement that reflects the courage and wisdom of these two leaders.
Both men said the treaty would not have been possible without President Carter's help. President Carter was not as successful in dealing with the economy. High unemployment and inflation continued. The federal deficit increased, although he had promised to end it. And there was a shortage of gasoline. The shortage resulted when oil-producing countries limited production and exports. Carter urged American companies to develop new sources of energy in addition to oil. He said the United States needed to do this because it could not always depend on getting enough oil from other countries.
This intolerable dependence on foreign oil threatens our economic independence and the very security of our nation. The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never. From now on, every new addition to our demand for energy will be met from our own production and our own conservation. The generation-long growth in our dependence on foreign oil will be stopped dead in its tracks right now.
During the gasoline shortage, Americans had to wait in long lines to buy fuel. They did not like it and were angry. Many were even more angry about a different situation. Like the gasoline shortage, it was a result of actions in another distant place.
Good evening. The U.S. Embassy in Tehran has been invaded and occupied by Iranian students. The Americans inside have been taken prisoner.
On November 4th, 1979, Muslim extremists in Iran seized the American embassy in Tehran. They took many hostages, including more than 60 Americans. The extremists said they were punishing the United States for being friendly with ousted Iranian leader Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The extremists refused to negotiate. They refused to release the hostages. In early April 1980, President Carter broke off diplomatic relations with Iran. He then ordered American military forces to try to rescue the hostages in Tehran. The operation failed. A sandstorm caused two of the aircraft to crash into each other. They went down in the desert, hundreds of kilometers away. The failed rescue attempt had a major effect on the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Many Americans felt it showed that he could not do the job. Their respect for him continued to decrease as the hostages continued to be held. Other things were beginning to go wrong, too. The president's younger brother, Billy, admitted receiving a large amount of money from Libya. He took the money in exchange for supporting Libyan interests with American lawmakers. His mistake was that he did not list his name as a representative of a foreign government. '80 was a presidential election year in the United States. President Carter was expected to be the candidate of the Democratic Party, but his chances were almost ruined because of the situation in Iran. Carter hoped that concern for the hostages would unite the country behind him. Instead, support turned to blame. Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts believed he could defeat Carter for the nomination. Kennedy won several important Democratic primary elections. But that was not enough. The party renominated Carter. Kennedy offered Carter his support, but not very strongly. This left the party divided. The Republicans got ready to win back the White House. They hoped to do it with a strong appeal to American voters. The appeal came from a man who would become one of America's most popular presidents, Ronald Reagan.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.